Hi. Good to be here.
Well, Dr. Mooney is a member of the social sciences faculty at the Open University of Scotland. He's also an author, and he's speaking tonight at 7:30 in the Freed Kurd Auditorium in the Martha Lane Collins Industry and Technology Center. He also speaks tomorrow afternoon to the MSU Department of History Research Seminar. Allow me to welcome you to Western Kentucky.
Thank you.
And given that you study social issues, particularly, albeit primarily Scottish ones, I have to ask how you're finding Western Kentucky society.
I've only been here a day, so it's, it's a lot to try and catch up. And I mean, one of the things that struck me already is about the topography. Mm. It was a lot greener than I was expecting. I came from Wisconsin and everything was really brown. I come from the rain capital of the known universe. And I just phoned home this morning and it's raining as usual in Scotland. But I've already learned a lot about, you know, Kentucky history, going back to the days of the Civil War, etc. But it's not a place I have to confess that I know that much about. But I'm hoping my journey here will illuminate me.
Well, your lecture is called Goodbye to the United Kingdom, Contested National Identities, Scottish Independence, and the 2012 Olympic Games. Now, excepting the Olympics part, which I think we all understand, could you talk a little bit about those terms and how they fit together?
Well, if you don't mind, could I start with the Olympic Games? Because I think if you look at the Olympic opening ceremony, and I'm sure many people over here did see it, although I'm not sure they saw it all, it did construct and represent a particular sense of Britishness. Britain is a very modern, multicultural, multi-ethnic enterprise. And one of the arguments that's come out of the Olympic Games is that it was a very huge success for the UK. The British team did well, not the Scottish team. There's no Scottish team at this stage. Britain did well. The running of the Games was a success for the UK. But what about Scotland? Well, of course, there was a number of Scottish athletes competing in the Games and did well, but people have started to say, well, given the success of this British enterprise and British endeavour, has this put Scottish independence back? Has this put Scottish plans for, you know, independence in reverse? Now, of course, you've raised the issue about national identity there, and of course there is something called British national identity, albeit very ambiguous, very contested, very fought over. National identities are fluid. I mean, they shift over time, so they're not fixed in any way. But one of the arguments about the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games was that from a more conservative perspective, it was too left-wing. It didn't have enough Spitfires, it didn't have enough Winston Churchill, it didn't have enough Second World War iconic images. But from the left, from a more socialist perspective, they were critical of it because they thought it gave a very sanitised view of British history and didn't have much about the British role in slavery and oppression overseas and the colonies and so on. So the Olympic Games threw up important questions about national identity. In the Scottish context, what we've seen, though, is a strengthening of a feeling of Scottishness in recent decades. And part of that is down to Scottish devolution, the establishment of a Scottish Parliament in 1999. But in some ways, there's always been a strong sense of Scottish national identity. It's become stronger, a feeling that Scotland is a separate entity from the rest of the UK.
What is the ultimate aim? I mean, there you have this region with limited self-government, as you said, a parliament. What is the ultimate aim? Is there going to be another country called Scotland at some point? Is that the end of that chain?
Well, I'm going to pull you up on something if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
You used the term region. Most people in Scotland would bristle at the thought that you used the term region, because Scotland is a separate nation. And what we have to remember is that when the United Kingdom was formed in 1707, what it did was bring together pre-existing nations, England, Wales, Scotland, of course, and more problematically, Ireland. And those national expressions, those national identities did not go away with the establishment of the United Kingdom. They've always been there. So there is something called Scotland, there is something called England, there is something called Wales, much more problematically called Northern Ireland, where there are expressions of a national sentiment that isn't necessarily British. So Britain represents this amalgamation of pre-existing national identities that have never really gone away, and at various points in time have either become more stronger or more diluted, depending on how successful Britain as an enterprise is.
Well, then I suppose before we go any farther, we really need to identify the term nation and the factors? What goes into making a nation?
Good question. Lots of different things go into making a nation. I mean, it's a very contested notion. But what I would like you to think about, in my part of the world, coming from Scotland, I watch Scottish football. Mm. That's real football. Soccer. Not what you call football over here. So I watch Scottish football. I listen to the Scottish weather forecast. I drive on Scottish roads. I read Scottish newspapers. I watch Scottish television or BBC Scotland. Mm-hmm. Everything is badged as Scottish, and what that's trying to represent is a different set of values, a different cultural expression, a different political expression, a different sense of history. The problem, of course, and maybe you're alluding to this, not everyone in Scotland feels Scottish in exactly the same way. I'm sure the 350 million people in the United States don't all feel American in the same way. Mm. But nonetheless, there is something there that implies a sense of a shared community of some kind, albeit it's fought over and contested and ambiguous.
What would that be for someone who is Scottish? I mean, I'm sure that their cultural touchstones like Bannockburn and Stirling Bridge are radically different than, say, Hastings or Shrewsbury would be for an Englishman.
It depends on who you're asking. Now, that's not a get-out, but it very right. much depends on who you're asking. I mean, certainly many Scots will know that history, going back to, you know, battles 700-800 years ago. But in today's world, they're largely meaningless. So we want to try and get beyond the sort of Braveheart view of Scotland and Scottishness. Now, I think for much of the past 50, 60 years, being Scottish was defined as not being English. And that was quite important. And you already have, you know, when I come here, people say, what part of England are you from? Which is not the thing to say to somebody from Scotland. So that doesn't always go down well. So it was defined as a negative thing. We're not English. Yeah. Mm. So what is it to be Scottish? Well, there is, again, an argument that Scotland represents a particular cultural view and political view in the world. Many people think that Scotland is a more collectivist country than the rest of the UK, slightly more left of centre, greater support for public services. Those are the things that, for many people in Scotland, mark out Scottishness. Hmm. Again, not everyone in Scotland would buy into that necessarily.
Well, let me very quickly follow that up by asking, do you think that comes from a more extended family notion of Scottish history?
I'm not sure what you mean by extended.
Well, I don't want to use the stereotypical term clan.
Right.
But essentially what we're talking about is an extended family, a closely knit group that has to survive in a place that's not the most fertile set of plains in the world. So do you think that idea of dealing with public services and things like that, that collectivist sense, whatever there is of it, it comes from that history?
I think there's an element of that. I'm not sure it's directly related to the history. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly a strong tradition of people helping each other out, not in a sort of community sense that you may understand it here in this part of the United States, but in a sense that public services, public support for public services, mm-hmm. is how things should be run in the Scottish context. So if you take, for example, the National Health Service, and I know national healthcare is a big issue here in the USA, the National Health Service in Scotland is something that's, you know, very much welcomed, supported, mm-hmm. an iconic thing, but not just in Scotland, but also across the rest of the UK. Now, what's happened in England is that certain sections of the National Health Service have been taken out of public control and public ownership, being privatised in our terms. That's not happening in Scotland because people were opposed to that.
Really?
So there is a strong sense in Scotland that public support, public services should be run by government and by the state, and that's the Scottish way of doing things.
Yeah. Well, before we came on air, you said this is not your first trip to the United States. So you have a little bit more experience with this country. I'm curious to know how the UK's notion of nation differs from the one that you have found here.
Well, what you have in the UK is competing senses of nation for starters. So there's Scottish nation, English nation, Welsh nation. I'll leave Ireland out of the context if you don't mind. But there's also a thing called Britishness. Mm-hmm. And that's very problematic. I mean, there is a sense of British nationalism. Now, that tends to be a bit more right-wing, a bit more conservative. But that's the Britain of empire. That's the Britain of the Royal Navy. That's the Britain of the military operations overseas. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you have in America, maybe with the exception of Texas, competing nations or competing senses of places wanting to break away necessarily. The thing that always strikes me about America, though, is the very explicit waving of the stars and stripes. People have that attached to houses and all these kind of things. You don't see that in Scotland, or you don't see that in England, maybe apart from football, tournaments getting played. You don't have people necessarily giving support to the military. But, I've been on planes here, and, the first person to come on would be a serving soldier or, airman or woman. People stand up, applaud that. You would never see that in the UK, for example.
Really? Yeah?
So I think those kind of expressions of Americanism don't play out in the same way in the UK at all.
Why is that? I mean, why, having seen that quite a bit in the United States, why don't they do that in the UK?
I think it's because the UK represents a whole set of different traditions in politics.
Ah.
And there's a lot of opposition to military involvement in wars overseas, particularly in Scotland, might I add. Now, of course, there are Scottish regiments serving in the British Army today in Afghanistan, but the vast majority of Scots want Scotland out of that kind of a overseas operation. Mm. And for many people in the UK, it represents a Britain of the past. We've moved on, allegedly, from the days of Britain sending troops and ships and aircraft around the world, surely. Mm. That's the argument anyway.
Are you seeing any analogies to what's happening in Scotland, this peaceful transition, certainly by comparison? Are you seeing any analogies anywhere else in the world to what's happening there?
Well, I think that's important. I mean, if you look at Europe in particular, if you look at Spain, there are two parts of Spain at the moment where people are very much moving towards some degree of self-rule. Mm-hmm. Catalonia, main capital being Barcelona, of course. Only a few weeks ago, 1 million people took to the streets of Barcelona demanding independence for Catalonia from Spain. You go to northwest Spain, to the Basque country, to the city of Bilbao. Their identity isn't Spanish, it's Basque. Mm-hmm. In Belgium, Belgium is split down the middle between Flemish-speaking Belgium to the north, French-speaking Belgium to the south. And obviously not too far north from here, you've got in Quebec,
right,
another history of a movement of a people who see themselves as independent or separate from the rest of the overall country in which they're located. So although we live in this world of so-called globalization, where everything apparently is becoming the same or becoming similar, you can identify in different parts of the world arising more localized, I don't want to use the term regional, but more localized expressions of difference and movements towards some degree of self-rule or self-control.
Well, as you mentioned, we're moving towards a more global society. How does that fit in with this? How is the idea of nation going to develop as we become more interconnected?
Well, we become more interconnected in certain ways, but not necessarily in others. And I mean, if you think that nation is a problematic idea, I think globalization is an even more problematic notion. You go and put globalization into Google, goodness knows how many hits you're going to get there. It's a very contested, fought over idea once again. Yes, we live in an interconnected world. You and I can email each other. That's great. What we have to remember is that most of the world are not connected in those ways that we in the West can enjoy and take for granted. But in this globalized world, it would appear that control over people's lives is moving further and further away. Hmm. It's happening at a more supranational, international level, not necessarily at the immediate local level. So the demand for some degree of local control, decentralization, devolution, whatever you want to call it, I think is also something that's accompanied globalization.
Do you think it's a reaction?
Possibly a reaction, but not always the same way everywhere.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's turn very quickly to the lecture that you're giving at Murray State's MSU Department of History Research Seminar tomorrow. You'll be talking about the history of the Open University and its relationship to the BBC. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what your remarks are going to be?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the OU began late 1960s, early 1970s, set up by the Labour government under Harold Wilson as an attempt to bring higher education, quality higher education, to a much larger proportion of the UK population. And from its very early days, the OU had a built-in relationship with the BBC, which was expanding new television channels, new radio channels at that time, whereby we would deliver lots of our teaching over the air. So the idea of the university of the air became very much part of what the OU, as we call it, was about. We've moved a long way from there. We've gone through the video age, which people have fought over and remember fondly. We've gone through the days of CDs. now in the days of interactive DVDs and DVD-ROMs. But if you look online, there's a lot of OU content on iTunes University. We do a lot of different things with the BBC now. For example, if you look at BBC America, there'll be programmes on there that were produced in association with my university, the Open University. Frozen Planet being a very, very popular one.
Right.
Programmes like Coast, which is really popular in the UK, is an OU BBC co-production. And what we do is, in addition to what's broadcast on the BBC, we produce online learning materials for folks to follow up. So what the BBC has and what the OU have is a commitment to public education, and we work in partnership to try and achieve that.
Has it always been a smooth partnership?
No, it hasn't. Sometimes what the BBC wants is maybe not what the OU wants, what the OU wants is maybe not what the BBC wants. But I think together, what we have done is produced very, very good television, but also educational television. I mean, the BBC's remit is, first of all, entertainment, let's be honest.
Right.
Ours is education. So sometimes that balance is not always a balance that's easy to make. But I think the relationship, generally speaking, is a very good relationship.
Do you think that, given the kind of content you find on the BBC with Open University, but also things like Blue Peter, the children's show, Living on Mars, Doctor Who, Blackadder, all of these kinds of different programs, the stuff that they offer on the radio, do you think that that is a result or a manifestation of what these people, what people in the UK expect from their media?
Yes.
Really?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, I don't want to celebrate Britishness here, but I think the BBC is probably the world's best broadcasting corporation. Mm-hmm. I don't have any doubt about that. But what we produce is very, very good television, very good critical documentary work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not for everyone. I appreciate that. That's why there's multiple BBC channels.
Right.
Most people love the BBC because there's no adverts. You know, we pay we have to buy a television license, as you may know, in the UK. That pays for the BBC. So there's no adverts, there's no commercials. That's very popular. But it's a commitment to public broadcasting. And, I mean, Sky Television under Rupert Murdoch have obviously come in the last couple of decades, also become very influential, very important, but also quite costly for many folks. And it doesn't necessarily sit with the sort of BBC tradition, which is the good documentary.
Right.
You know.
Well, was that expectation there prior to 1927?
I think it was there from the start.
Really?
Yes, I think it was there from the start. A commitment to public education, public broadcasting, that's what the BBC does really, really well.
And it seems to have basically feeds back into the viewer / listener, back into the BBC and Open University.
Yes, I mean, I mean, going back to this, if you don't mind, about Scottish independence,
certainly.
Yeah? I think if Scotland was to become independent, the big issue that opens up is what happens to these iconic UK-wide institutions that people, I don't want to say love in that sense, but respect. What happens to the BBC? What happens to the National Health Service? What happens to public sector pensions? We're all part of that on a UK-wide basis. And already there's a debate being opened up about Scottish independence. What happens to the BBC? Will we have a Scottish Broadcasting Corporation? Well, I might vote for Scottish independence, but if Scottish Broadcasting Corporation means all the sort of kitsch Scottish things that people might expect,
right,
then I would rather have the BBC than that. But it's about getting the two together. That's what's really important.
So for you, quality is going to trump that national?
Oh, I think so. I think so. I mean, I think I would like the BBC to do more stuff around Scotland and other parts of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
It can become a bit London-centric from my perspective. But beyond that, what you get is very good quality programmes.
Author and educator Dr. Jerry Mooney is with the Open University in Scotland. He speaks tonight at 7:30 in the Friedkirk Auditorium at Murray State's Collins Industry and Technology Centre. Dr. Mooney, thanks for coming up and talking to us.
Well, thank you very much for having me here.